Today's scripture verse is from 1 Corinthians chapter 13, verses 4 through 7. Love is patient. Love is kind. It isn't jealous. It doesn't brag. It isn't arrogant. It isn't rude. It doesn't seek its own advantage. It isn't irritable. It doesn't keep a record of complaints. It isn't happy with injustice, but it is happy with the truth. Love puts up with all things, trust in all things, hope for all things, endure all things. This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. You may be seated.
Thanks, Larry. And good morning, friends. Let me add my welcome to Pastor Eric, because my name is Chris Abel. I'm our lead pastor here. And if you're a guest with us, I know why you're here. It's because you decided that this is your last-ditch effort to support the Chiefs. You're like, I haven't been to church in 20 years, but I'm here today, so let's do something, God. And if that's you, I hope you're right. And I don't know about you, but I've never been this excited about football in my life. And I am super psyched about the Super Bowl going on today. I cannot believe it's actually happening. This is pretty exciting. But not only am I excited, not only are you excited, not only is all Kansas City excited, but our Learning Ladder preschool here is pretty excited too. I don't know if you saw this picture on our Facebook this week, but we had two of our classes do like a Patrick Mahomes headband art project. And then this was our highest liked post of all time on our Facebook page. Which I'll take it. And then it got in the local news, so that's awesome. I just love that our preschool is so supportive of the Chiefs. They also like Jesus, so that's neat too. So I've been caught up in the Super Bowl fever and talking about football every day, daily. There's one catch, though, is that I don't know what I'm talking about. I think they call this fair weather fans, and I have to confess, I'm definitely a fair weather fan, especially I grew up in New England, but we don't have to talk about that. It's a sore topic for a lot of people. Okay, so when it comes to football, though, it doesn't keep me from having an opinion, even though I don't know what I'm talking about. This week alone, I had a conversation with our facilities staff. His name's Steven, and Steven and I were talking, and I think I fooled him to thinking I knew a little bit about football, because I remember saying, you know, with the draft, did you hear that we got rated, like, we had a C-rated draft, that people thought our draft was terrible, and that people overlooked Mahomes, but for some reason, we saw Mahomes as if we is me. I had nothing to do with it. And so this is something that, but still, I have an opinion. Another time, another conversation. I've been saying this for weeks now. I heard it one time, and I repeat it to make it sound like I know what I'm talking about. I said, did you know in the last two seasons that we haven't lost a game by more than 7 points? I mean, I didn't watch any of those games, but... But that sounds like a pretty impressive statistic. And it's because I like having an opinion about things that are important. And chances are that you like having an opinion about things that people are talking about too. In fact, we do this with all sorts of things. But today we're going to talk about how we have opinions about relationships, about all sorts of different relationships. One that was in the news in the last few weeks, you are probably familiar with, Meghan Markle and Prince Harry ended up leaving the royal family. Did you hear about this? I know some of you, people who follow it, they follow it. I went and visited my mom in Florida for a week of Christmas. She was just talking every day. Somehow it came up. I'm like, why do you care about the royal family? You know, you live in Florida. And yet it came up again and again. And people have all sorts of opinions. People say really kind of strong stuff. You know what? This was her plan all along, was to find a prince and then steal him from the royal family. You know, people have really strong opinions. And then people also, they say about him, they're like, oh, he's a millennial. He doesn't know anything about commitment. He's just betraying his family to follow some girl. You know, people have some pretty strong opinions. But you know what? When it comes to Meghan and Harry, we don't know them. And not only do we not know them, we don't know what their relationship is like. The only two people who know what their relationship like is Meghan and Harry. It could be, very well be that when it comes to them leaving the royal family, it could be that Meghan is a supportive spouse and has real and has seen this incredible pressure that he was born into and wants to give him a chance of pursuing his own life purpose instead of just being handed one by his family. Like maybe that's what's actually happening in the marriage, but we don't know because we're not in their marriage. And so this is one of the things. It doesn't keep us from still having opinions about people's marriages, about people's relationships. That this is something that we chronically do as people. It's that we don't just do this with celebrities. We do this with each other, and sometimes we even do this to ourselves. Is we have a perception about our own relationships and how they fall short or how they exceed. Or something. We just have lots of different stuff going on in our heads and our hearts when it comes to relationships, which is why we're starting this series, Love, Heartbreak, and Trainwrecks, because relationships are a huge part of our world. Either you're in one, you want to be in one, you were in one, or other people's relationships impact your life. Sure, somehow we have woven into our day-to-day lives our opinion about relationships, not just their relationships, but also your relationship. So before we talk about this more, I want to spend a little bit of time understanding where our opinions about relationships come from. Now, sometimes we can think that opinions just kind of float out there, that they are formed on their own. And when it comes to our view of different people's marriages or different people's relationships, we think that we're objective observers, that we are making purely rational, purely intellectual observations about someone's relationship. So when you're looking at someone's relationship, you think, well, I don't have any biases. I don't have any agenda. I just have pure intellect. That's how we often think about our opinions, not just relationships, but lots of things. It's a challenge in the 21st century because everybody can put their opinions up, and it's sometimes hard to sort fact from opinion. So this is what we do with relationships, though. But opinions do not appear out of nowhere. They don't appear out of the blue. Opinions come from a place. And for us, when it comes to relationships, our opinions come from a template, a relationship template that all of us have. All of us have in our heads an idea of what relationships look like. And we have this template that we work from. Sometimes our templates are unhealthy. Sometimes our templates can hurt us. Sometimes our templates can be especially judgy. Sometimes our templates can be very, very narrow. And sometimes our templates can be pretty broad. But we all have a template of what relationships look like. And that doesn't even come out of the blue. We don't just create that because we decide to sit down and write up our template of what we think relationships look like. No. Templates come from somewhere as well. Templates come from our environments, what kind of family you come from, where you grew up, all sorts of different things. And so I want to explore this a little bit. Our ideas of what relationships look like come from the environments that we've experienced. See, you believe something about relationships because of what you've experienced in your life, your environments that you've come from. You know, so here's an example here. A lot of us have an environment of family that has influenced what we think about relationships. And so when it comes to relationships, you look at often your parents or grandparents or some kind of figures in your life that you have a perspective about relationships that you learn from your environment that shapes your template, that shapes your opinions. Now, sometimes it can be a really negative environment. That family environment could have been toxic or could have been abusive. And so you formed a template that was based on something that was broken. And so your template might be, you need to be on guard with your relationships because you never know who someone really is under the surface. And if you get stuck with someone bad, like that might be the template that you've inherited because your environment taught you that view of relationships. On the flip side, you might have had a family environment that was great, and you saw love in a way that is rare in this world. But that can be a challenge too, because then what happens is you form a template, and then you assume that the person that you begin to have a relationship with needs to fit that template that was unique to your family. Well, the challenge, not everybody, you're married, your relationship won't necessarily look like your parents did. And sometimes that can be hard for us to overcome because we begin to hold that person then to a standard that we formed from how we grew up. Some of you have experienced this in your own lives, and you've experienced this when you're looking for someone. You're looking for someone through the eyes of the environment you grew up in. All right, so that's family. There's Different things that make up our environments, though. We have fiction that makes up our environment, which sounds kind of silly, but there's narratives that influence people's lives. A lot of us grew up watching Disney movies. Maybe you grew up watching, I was going to say Bambi, but I don't think Bambi has any romance in it. I picked the one Disney movie. So there's this Disney idea of romance. There's narratives, there's movies. And what often happens with the narrative of romance and the narrative of relationship in movies is, you know, the two people meet and they fall in love and it's awesome and it's fireworks and then there's huge drama and then things fall apart and then there's resolution. You know, every one of these like romance movies has like a plot line and they're all the same just with different settings. And then this is like a constant narrative that shaped your template of what a relationship is it's supposed to be this like high highs and low lows and drama and or maybe you watched reality TV and that informed what your template of relationships is. So fiction impacts what we've read and the stories that we've grown up with impact our environments, which impact our templates. The third thing that impacts our environments, which impact our templates, which impact our opinions, is just cultural views of what relationships are. And so I went to India a few years ago. And it was part of a seminary trip, and we got to go have an interreligious dialogue with all these different religions in India, which is a democracy with all these different, it was really fascinating. And while I was there, so all these billboards, and every billboard had a very fair-skinned Indian person on it, and yet most of the people I interacted with had very dark complexions. And I asked someone, I was like, hey, what's up with all these boards? And they said, well, in India, you know, we have a cultural view that beauty has to do with more fair skin. And so they have this cultural environment that says that beauty and attraction has something to do with the tone of your skin color, which is part of the culture that they have there, which is not great. But we have our own kind of Western cultural view of relationships. And this is going to sound like a little bit of a caricature, and that's because it's a little bit of a caricature. But society as a whole sometimes implants in us an environment which has a certain view of what a relationship looks like. And often in our culture, our mental picture of marriage is of a man and a woman, and they're both fit, and they're both white, and they have 3.5 kids, and I just realized today that the 0.5 was like a dog. I don't know if I thought they had half of a child. But they're above average attractiveness. He's over 6 feet tall. She wears makeup to bed. They have two, it's kind of the perception. We have, and it's on the movies too, and two brand new cars in the garage. He works. She stays at home but has a master's degree. He's ambitious and she's supportive. Like, this is a little bit of the cultural view when we think of like snapshot, like in a split second. What do you think of when you think of like relationships in Western culture? That's kind of what comes to mind. And it doesn't matter if you fit this or not. This is kind of the cultural thing that shapes a lot of our templates within shapes our opinions. And I share all this because our view and our opinions about relationships don't just come from one place. It's not as if it descends from heaven and there's a template or a cookie cutter or a mold to what relationships look like. And yet, in a lot of churches, and in a lot of what Christians believe, is that these things aren't true. That there actually isn't influence when it comes to the Christian view of marriage. That it's just something that exists, and it's firm, and it was handed to us by God, and there's no flexibility, and there's no input, and there's no subjectivity to it. Somehow, the church has gotten to a place where we aren't interested in talking about how there's other factors that go into what we observe, what marriage is, or what relationships are supposed to be. And sometimes we talk about it under the guise of this, of biblical marriage. This is kind of the key phrase. When you're talking to people, if this comes up, this is kind of the idea. It's this recent phenomenon, this recent idea that marriage isn't actually influenced from all those different factors, but just an exact idea of what God wants for us in a very particular way. And this is kind of what people mean when they say biblical marriage. Another phrase that often gets this is another buzzword that gets tied into this. If you hear people say the sanctity of marriage, what they're saying is there's this exact way that marriage is supposed to look like. This is what and it doesn't take into account any of the other things that influence our views of what a relationship looks like. And I'm sharing this, and I'm broaching this today because I want you to know this, what we're talking about today. I want you to know more about what the Christian faith actually says about relationships. And not just for your own relationship, but because the church has done a lot of harm to people with trying to fit them into a cookie-cutter approach and trying to force them into a mold that isn't there. And so this is what I want to spend our time doing, is unpacking what the Bible actually says about what relationships should look like. Now, here's the reality. If you want to talk about biblical marriage, if you want to model your marriage after the predominant marital practice in the Bible, it would be polygamous. Which is weird to say in church, right? You didn't come in today. You're like, I wish there was a football-themed sermon. Why is this on the screen? And here's why. If you grew up in church, you grew up in Sunday school, you heard stories of these great biblical characters, especially in the Old Testament. You know, you heard stories of King David and of Abraham and of all these people. And then what happens is every once in a while you'll bump into, and then they had a fourth wife. And you'll say, all right, that's a little weird. And then let's just put that aside and ignore it and then focus on the rest of the story. This is what we all do so that we can get something good out of it. If we paused for every weird thing we felt in the Bible, we wouldn't get through a lot of it. We'd have a lot of challenges and questions to ask. But here's the thing. When it comes to this, most of the heroes of old, what we read about in the Bible, that was their way that they practiced marriage. Names like Abraham and his grandsons, Jacob and Esau. Moses, who freed the Israelites out of slavery in Egypt, who was the highest person of regard in the Jewish faith. Moses had multiple wives. Saul, the first king of Israel. And you say, well, the first king of Israel, he had some issues, but the next one was great. Well, David had multiple wives. In fact, David had 8 wives. And every once in a while, what happens in Christian devotions will be like, David and Abigail, they were just so great. But then he saw Bathsheba, and David and Bathsheba, and they're so great. And then what do we just forget about the other wife while we're focusing on one devotion at a time? David had 8 wives and 10 concubines. And concubines for the Jewish, Judaism at the time, concubines were marital companions with an inferior status to wife. So those women couldn't be married to anyone else. They were basically already in a relationship, but they didn't even have the low status of what a wife did in these ancient times. This is King David, who had a heart after God's own heart. What do we do with that? And then Solomon, his son, who is apparently, supposedly, this is the narrative we say about Solomon, the wisest person who ever lived. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Solomon had 1,000 women in his orbit. That doesn't sound like wisdom to me. Like, these are the stories in the Bible. These are the predominant marriages in the Bible, and there's 41 different times in the Old Testament that references like the stories of people, the people that we tell as heroes, stories of heroes that have concubines. 41 different times that this lifestyle is practiced. This is not just a blip. This is not just a few people making a mistake. This is the predominant way that religion is practiced. Sure, you might say, well, Adam and Eve, they were different. Well, Adam and Eve, sure, that might be that's the creation story. But then after that, that's not the norm. That's actually the exception to the rule for most of the Bible. And the Old Testament is like three-fifths of the Bible. It's like four-fifths of the Bible. It's this huge part of the Bible. Now, you might say, well, Chris, what about the New Testament? You know, there's no polygamy there. And you'd be right to say that, and you're right. There's no polygamy in the New Testament. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't practiced by people of the day. And so I'm hoping this helps put things in perspective here. In his book, Christian Marriage, a Historical and Doctrinal Study, George Hayward Joyce wrote this. He said this, "When the Christian church came into being, polygamy was still practiced by the Jews. It is true that we find no references to it in the New Testament, but from this, some have inferred that it must have fallen into disuse, and that at the time of our Lord, the Jewish people had become monogamous. But the conclusion appears to be unwarranted. Josephus, who is the premier Jewish historian of the first century, almost everything we know about the first century comes from his writings. Josephus, in two places, speaks of polygamy as a recognized institution, and Justin Martyr makes it a matter of reproach to Trypho that the Jewish teachers have permitted a man to have several wives. So it's practiced in the first century. But Christians, the first Christians, lived differently. They practiced a different way of life. They had monogamous relationships. This was the big distinction between the previous religion and what emerged as Christianity, that they had a commitment between two people. Now, Paul actually mentions this as a factor for the few references we have to polygamy in the New Testament are actually Paul, who's writing to some young leaders about who they're choosing as leaders in the church, in the early church. And so Paul wrote to Timothy, and twice in his letter to Timothy, he mentions polygamy, and then once in his letter to Titus. And here's the letter to Titus and what he says. He says, "For this reason, I left you behind in Crete, so that you would set right what remains unfinished." Which means that all these different people were becoming Christians, and so he was trying to help. He had to leave, but he left Titus in charge to basically help find people who could be pastors of these different Christian communities that were coming up around Crete. And I appoint elders in every city. So elder is just another word for kind of a pastor. In the United Methodist Church, I'm considered an elder. It's my title, my ordination title, even though I'm not very old, but if you want to call me Mister, you can. And in every city, as I directed you, namely a man of unquestionable integrity, the husband of one wife, having children who believe and not accused of being immoral or rebellious. So three different times of those four criteria, one of them is, hey, you got to have one person. This is a conflict of interest if you want to be a leader in the church. So he has to specify this in his letters to the early church. So this is Paul's perspective. But here's the thing, Paul grew up Jewish, and so he saw this being practiced. So why was he saying something different from the practice of his Hebrew Bible? Well, where did the switch come from? Well, we actually historically know where the switch came from. And it came because of this guy. This is Alexander the Great, or at least a statue of his head. And Alexander the Great was known for the Macedonian Empire, which spread throughout the known world, and basically at one point, 300 years before Christ, took over the known world, including Israel. And so the Macedonian Empire was basically a primitive Greek society, and so they had Greek ideals and Greek culture, and they had some Koine Greek as a language. And so this was, when they spread throughout the world, they introduced this culture into all the places that they controlled. Now, the Macedonian Empire came and went, and some other things rose, but the culture of this empire had already kind of seeped into these different areas that they had not conquered, but kind of ruled over. And then when Rome came in to the picture, Rome came in about 60 years before Jesus was born, and Rome was extremely Greek-influenced. And so this Greco-Roman, anytime you hear that, Greco-Roman is a Greek-influenced Roman culture, they took over, and they just even more emphasized this culture to the point where our Bible is written in Greek and not Hebrew because it had so influenced culture. That's why the New Testament's written in this different language, that the Greek culture had so infiltrated here. And as part of their Greco-Roman culture, they were monogamous. This is where monogamy entered the biblical world as we know it. This is what historian Walter Schiedel from Stanford wrote. He said this, "By contrast, socially imposed universal monogamy." So by the way, socially imposed universal monogamy. This is his fancy way of saying there was no actual laws for this, but people's cultural environments were so strong that their templates for marriage and their opinions about marriage were monogamous. Not because they had to make a rule, because everybody in the culture felt this. And so they had a universal monogamy through social pressure, through what people believed about what marriage looked like. It was firmly established as the only legitimate marriage system in Greece. This was distinct from a lot of different places in the world at this time. Polygamy was considered a barbarian custom and or a mark of tyranny. When it says tyranny there, what would happen is you'd get Solomon-like situations where people with great power would basically keep wives to himself, and then what would happen is lower status men in society wouldn't have access to wives. And so basically there was this tyranny of relationship. You'd be keeping people from being able to be married because you took all the resources for yourself. That's just a way to think about it in that particular way. This still happens in some countries today, by the way, and it creates radicalism in those young men because they want to be in relationships. And so polygamy has actually kept them from being able to find mates. And monogamy was regarded as quintessentially Greek. There is no sign of an early polygamous tradition in Rome. Okay, so Chris, what's the history lesson here? Here's why I'm sharing all this with you today. Because it irks me when people talk about biblical marriage as if it's a clear, straightforward thing in the Bible. Hopefully, historically, looking at Scripture, you can see that that is not the case. I don't want you to take my word for it. I want you to see historically what happened here. And for Christians, we did not get our idea of monogamy from Judaism. We did not get it from the Old Testament. We got it from a pagan empire that took over and shared its culture. And Christianity realized, oh, this is better. This form of marriage is actually more fair. This form of marriage honors more people. This form of marriage is the better way to do it. And so Christians adopted this form of marriage and then took it to the next level. That's where our view of marriage comes from. This idea of biblical marriage is not intellectually honest. And here's why I'm risking boring you with history, because we can't honestly and with intellectual integrity claim that the modern Christian version of marriage is spelled out in the Bible. You have to jump through a lot of hoops logically to get a strict cookie-cutter version of marriage. Now, you might be thinking, Chris, this is the worst sermon that I've ever heard. It sounds like you're dismissing marriage. No wonder you're not married. You heretic. Like, this might be what you're thinking. And if you're not saying that, then you're probably wondering, okay, my relationship is in no danger of polygamy. Nothing you've said has been helpful to me. I didn't like history in school, and I don't like it now. Like, maybe, let's talk about football again. Like, maybe this is your perspective, and you would have fair points to say that. But here's why I've spent so much time debunking this idea of a biblical marriage. And I'm pretty new at this church, too, so I'm taking some risks to talk about this stuff. And I'm talking about it because it matters. I'm talking about it because we have something better. We have something better than biblical marriage. We have Christian marriage. We have Christian marriage. And you might say, well, aren't those the same thing? No. No, they're not. They're not the same thing. They're not the same thing. And here's why. To understand this, I want to first go to a passage that many of you are familiar with. And some of you, if you're married, may have had this read at your marriage. And you heard it read just a few moments ago. And it's from 1 Corinthians 13. And let's look at it again. Love is patient, love is kind, it isn't jealous, it doesn't brag, it isn't arrogant, it isn't rude, it doesn't seek its own advantage, it isn't irritable, it doesn't keep a record of complaints, it isn't happy with injustice, but it is happy with truth. Love puts up with all things, trusts in all things, hope for all things, endures all things. And the reason that so many people read this at their weddings is because these are the qualities that somebody hopes for in their marriage. They want their spouse to be patient with them. They want someone who isn't going to use them. They want someone who won't change how they feel from one day to the next. They want someone who forgives them and allows them to grow. They want someone who sees the best in them and believes in them. And all of these things are great. This is a wonderful standard and a high standard that we have for marriage, except that this passage isn't about marriage. Paul wasn't writing this about relationships. This passage is written in the context of Paul talking to how Christians treat each other. He was talking about the early church and how these new communities were supposed to treat one another. And so we've taken a passage that's really supposed to be about how you treat everyone, and we've put it onto one relationship. This is another way to think about it. We've gotten it backwards. When Christians talk about marriage, Sometimes when we talk about biblical marriage, what we say is you have a high standard when it comes to your marriage. And you have to fulfill these exact things up here. And it's a high bar, and a lot of us fall short. But for everyone else, it's down here. But that one, you better do your marriage. But yeah, you treat people terribly, you know, and you're selfish, and you have weird, and you let injustice happen, and you're not kind to people, and you're self-serving. But boy, if you put that Christian marriage, that's the, you know, for some reason we've put that up as a priority, as a hierarchy, and then we've left it here. But what the New Testament, what Paul is actually teaching people is not that marriage doesn't matter, but that the standard for people and how you treat people is here, and then how you treat your spouse is here. Like, the difference is the bar is not here just for marriage. The bar is there for everyone, for how we treat just people. And so when it comes to 1 Corinthians 13, like, let's pull this back up. So it says this, love is patient. Well, let's read this again, and not as like a romantic or a romance or as a way of seeing relationships, but let's read this about how we treat just people. Like, love is patient. Man, patience is hard. Patience means that you actually match your pace to someone else's. That you don't rush someone or push someone or want something too soon. That you go at their pace. That's what patience is. This isn't just for a spouse. This is for everyone. Love is kind. I told this story, if you might have heard this a few months ago. But I moved, like 3.5 years ago, I moved to Leawood, and I remember I went to the local Starbucks, and I saw someone treat a barista like terribly, and I said to her, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Does that happen often? She said, oh, every day. And I said, really, why? And she said, it's Leawood. And not everyone in Leawood is like that, so I don't want to make a stereotype. But that the conversation legitimately happened, because in that environment, kindness was an afterthought or a weakness or something that wasn't, that people thought they were kind people except when they were interacting with people who made a minimum wage. You know, like that, like those people don't need kindness. You know, like so we have this high standard for marriage, but then we don't have this high standard for the people we interact with. He's kind, isn't jealous. By the way, jealousy and envy are different things. Jealousy is when you think somebody's going to take something of yours, and so you're threatened by someone. Envy is you want something of theirs. And so he says isn't jealous, isn't threatened by other people. It doesn't brag. It isn't arrogant. It's hard to love someone and look down on them as lesser. You can't do that. It doesn't seek its own advantage. It's not using people. It isn't irritable. I'm just going to let that one go. You know what that means. That one's hard. It doesn't keep a record of complaints. You always do this. Can you believe this? This is the habit. Oh, I see this in your, they always, you know, this idea that that the mistakes a person makes is who they are forever. It says love doesn't keep track of this stuff. It doesn't have a log book of every time this person's done something or disappointed you. It isn't happy with injustice, which means the opposite of this would be being joyful at injustice, being liking, enjoying when bad things happen to people. The German word for this is Schadenfreude, which is like you take joy at people's pain. Or this is usually, we talk about it usually with like YouTube videos when people are falling or something. Like, it's easy to laugh at people when things are going bad. And sometimes, and I even do this, is sometimes, you know, when somebody's on their high horse and gets knocked off, and there's a part of you that's like, yeah. Like, that's not love. Doesn't keep a record of complaints, isn't happy with injustice, but it is happy with the truth. And then Paul summarizes, love puts up with all things, trusts in all things, hope for all things, and endures for all things. And this is about relationships with everyone, not just your spouse. See, Christian marriage isn't just about lust or fireworks or their finances or your perception of what their relationship's supposed to look like. Christian marriage is, first and foremost, identifying your spouse, your person, your love interest as a son or daughter of God. That's the first label Christians put on their relationships. And then it also involves sex. And then maybe you have kids. And then you also build a life together. But first and foremost, they're a child of God. Now, I was talking with Beth, my girlfriend, about this a couple days ago. And she was saying, ooh, this is weird. I don't know if I like this. And she's like, I don't think of you as like a child of God first. That's a little weird. And I said, yeah, okay. And you might think that too, like, Chris, what do you want me to do? You want me to, like, set a candlelight dinner and lean in and look at my spouse and lean and say, I love that you're a child of God. You know, like, that doesn't really, that, none of us are probably excited about this concept here, right? But here's why we should be affirmed by this. Here's why we should be affirmed by this. Because the marriage then isn't tied to what you bring to the relationship. Marriage then doesn't have conditions you have to meet or else. Marriage then isn't how happy you make them. Marriage then isn't good as long as there's no stress. Marriage then isn't contingent on feelings of attraction. Marriage then is a promise between two followers of Christ who covenant to love each other like they love everyone else. That is what Christian marriage is at the core. It isn't cookie cutter. It isn't a mold. It is about first and foremost loving God's people, of whom your spouse is one, and to honor your covenant because you're a Christian, not because it's marriage. It's just one of the relationships that you have. And maybe you're here, and I want to close with this idea. Maybe you're here tonight, or this morning, and you've been comparing your marriage to some idea of marriage that you were handed somewhere in your past. And it doesn't match up, and you've been dissatisfied, and maybe God is challenging you to not compare them to an idea you have, but to see your person as a child of God, first and foremost, who you are called to love. Not because they're your husband or wife, but because you've decided to love the person next to you. Or maybe you're looking for a relationship and you haven't found it yet and you feel like everybody else gets to experience love in a way that you don't. And maybe God is saying to you that marriage isn't the factor that decides if you have value or not, or if you can experience love in your life or not. That first and foremost, that you are valuable because you are loved by God, and that romance isn't the same as purpose. And we mix those up. And maybe you're someone who's in a happy marriage. And you haven't had to work really hard at your marriage, and love comes naturally. And maybe God is saying to you, hey, it's not just between the two of you. I'm inviting you to love my people. Now, biblical marriage may not be something that's a cookie cutter or easy to hand out. But Christian marriage is something that doesn't just benefit you, but benefits everyone else. Would you pray with me? God, thank you for loving us and for challenging us and for pushing us sometimes out of our comfort zone or beyond the things that we think we know about our relationships in life. And so God, help us to be people who first and foremost follow you and love as you loved us. And then help us to be people who love our spouse. And God, as we're doing this series, be present in our relationships. Be present in who we are. And thank you for loving us. In your name we pray. Amen.